Thank you all so much for being here today. My name is Catherine Gologli. I'm a policy advisor here with the White House Domestic Policy Council. And I'm so pleased you can join us for what is likely the last public convening of the Obama White House on K-12 education. We are so grateful to have you here and to have a really thoughtful conversation around the President's Testing Action Plan, which he released last October. This is something the President takes personally, cares deeply about. He gets a lot of letters and has gotten in the past a lot of letters from parents, teachers, and students who worry that over-testing or unnecessary testing is taking some of the joy out of learning. And so he really wants us to be focused on how we can take action to improve assessment, to make it higher quality, and to make it better, fairer, and fewer. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn things over to Secretary of Education John King, a lifelong educator and a hero in this movement. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Catherine, and thank you to our White House colleagues for hosting us today. It's exciting to be here with all of you today to talk about the progress that states and districts represented here are making towards better, more useful assessments for our teachers, our students, our parents, and our families. In addition to psychometricians who create and validate assessments, we have with us here teachers and school leaders who use those tests to develop their instructional practice, and also teachers and school leaders who are developing their own assessments. We have tech developers who are putting that test content into more accessible, more engaging formats, and we have thought leaders and advocates here who are here to learn from the experiences of the folks who work in schools and from each other as we continue to work to make our assessments better. As you all recall, it was just over a year ago that President Obama announced the Testing Action Plan, calling for better, more useful assessments and an end to over-testing in America's classrooms. The President called for reducing duplicative, low-quality, and unnecessary testing to make time for more teaching and learning. That plan articulated key principles for high-quality assessments that are worth taking, that are fair, that are inclusive for all students, and that are used as only one of multiple measures for accountability purposes. Since then, the Department has been working to provide technical assistance and guidance to help states and districts achieve those principles and move closer to the goal of fewer, better, and fairer tests. We're grateful for the President's leadership in focusing us all on the urgency of creating smarter and more strategic assessment approaches for every student. Of course, ongoing, thoughtful assessment is essential to education and goes hand in hand with effective instruction. There cannot be one without the other. When done well, all assessments are tools for progress, accountability, and equity. They can provide educators, parents, and the public with a clear picture of student learning and expose achievement gaps so that we can push for improvement for all students. But as many of you have observed, when done poorly, testing can become a costly distraction, consuming an excessive amount of valuable instructional time while only asking low-level questions that require just memory and not demonstration of real understanding. Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Vancouver, Washington are good examples of what can happen when districts look closely at the assessments that are required. In each of these places, after doing inventories of their assessments, they were able to reduce the amount of testing time by nearly half. In Tulsa, the changes were based on the recommendations of teachers who participated in the district's assessment study group. In looking for ways to address concerns from parents about over-testing, Tulsa Superintendent Deb Guess recognized the importance of involving teachers and school leaders from the outset. In fact, the idea of having a committee to study assessments originated with the teachers' union in the district, and teachers were selected to participate by the Tulsa Classroom Teachers Association and by principals. The district also is supporting teachers and principals in using assessment data throughout the year in professional learning opportunities and instructional coaching. And I was fortunate to have the opportunity to visit Tulsa and to meet with educators there to talk about what they have achieved through a thoughtful audit of their assessments. In Vancouver, the district's review process was led by a team made up of teachers, program specialists, and school and district administrators. Their focus was on maintaining assessments for learning while minimizing assessments of learning. That priority helped them eliminate 105 assessments, some of which were given 3 or 4 times each year. Through that purpose-driven approach, the district restored an average of 900 minutes to the classroom in grades 3 through 8 without losing their ability to continually measure student progress and target resources to students who were struggling. At the high school level, the district added 2 new administrations and now requires the PSAT for all 10th graders and the SAT for all 11th graders, which will help them to ensure that every student has what they need to apply for college. Indeed, though we can celebrate the progress that we've made over the past 8 years in narrowing gaps of opportunity and promoting equity, we cannot back down from our insistence on meaningful accountability and transparency to ensure continued improvement for students. And what you see in the example from Tulsa or from Vancouver is that we can do both. We can thoughtfully review the assessments that are given. We can make better, smarter choices about the use of assessment time while maintaining a commitment to meaningful accountability for performance and a commitment to use assessments as a lever to continually improve instruction. Every student deserves a well-rounded education, one that sparks their interests and engages their talents, their passions, and their natural curiosity about the world. To develop the critical thinkers, the makers, and leaders of the future, we have to ensure all students have equal access to rigorous courses in math and English and science, but also rich experiences in social studies, world languages, and the arts. We have to make sure that our assessments support this vision of a well-rounded education for all students. The President's Action Plan, Testing Action Plan, was one in a series of steps the administration has taken to ensure every student has access to an excellent and well-rounded education that prepares them for college and careers. Now, you'll recall that 2 months after issuing the Testing Action Plan, the President signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, which in many ways codified this promise of a well-rounded, excellent education for all students, regardless of background, circumstance, disability, or language spoken at home. One of the most important things to know about ESSA is that it builds on the intent of the original Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, signed by President Johnson. That original law was a civil rights law, and the President signed the Every Student Succeeds Act because he believes that it builds on the civil rights legacy of the original law. Central to the success of ESSA is the commitment to transparency around the progress that students are making towards college and career readiness. ESSA requires states to administer to all students annual statewide assessments in reading, language arts, and mathematics in grades 3 through 8, and once in high school. It also requires assessments once each grade span in science for all students and English language proficiency assessments for all English learners. ESSA also requires that all students are tested, are offered appropriate accommodations when needed, and are held to the same high standards, including students with disabilities and English learners. Today, the department is releasing the final regulations for statewide assessments under Title I, Part A of ESSA, which clarify new flexibilities for states and districts to reduce testing and measure higher order thinking, to maintain effective protections to preserve student civil rights and ensure assessments are fair and inclusive, and to maximize the positive impact of transparent, consistent information about student learning and progress. Under the department's new regulations, which were developed with extensive input from stakeholders, states have more flexibility than under NCLB in designing their assessment systems while maintaining important protections to preserve student civil rights, including students with disabilities and students who are learning to speak English. For example, states may permit a district to use a locally selected, nationally recognized high school academic assessment, such as a college entrance exam, in place of the statewide high school assessment. States might shift to computer adaptive tests, which may provide a more precise estimate of a student's ability with fewer questions than traditional tests. Or they could eliminate double testing by allowing eighth graders who are taking advanced mathematics to take a test on that material and to skip the traditional eighth grade statewide assessment. That's just one of the options available to states. We're also releasing a second set of regulations for an innovative assessment pilot under Title I, Part B of ESSA. These regulations outline how states can take advantage of this new pilot and help develop the next generation of statewide assessments, phasing in their innovative assessment over time in a growing number of districts until it's given statewide. Through these and other efforts, states can go beyond the multiple choice and short answer questions at the end of the school year that are so familiar to all of us. Using technology, the experts in this field are making it possible for test questions to be more like real-world tasks, more like what our students are asked to do in college and on the job, solving problems and applying their knowledge to unique situations. Who knows? Students may even like taking these new types of assessments, especially if they provide students immediate feedback and empower them to take more control over their own learning. I hope we have an opportunity to see that today. To that end, today the department is also announcing $8 million in enhanced assessment grant awards to two groups of states, one led by the Maryland State Department of Education and the other led by the Nebraska Department of Education. These states are working to develop innovative science assessments aligned to the next generation science standards that are more hands-on and capture learning along multiple dimensions. We also have developers here who've received support from the Department's Small Business Innovation Research Program. These developers are partnering with researchers, psychometricians, and educators to build these technology-delivered and technology-enhanced assessments. Today, we have teachers and students in another room working with some of these developers to provide input on the new tools and to help us understand their needs for assessment and to help brainstorm how technology can make assessments more meaningful. Of course, with all its potential, technology also poses new challenges for assessment. As is the case with every complex problem we face in education, there is no one silver bullet. But as this convening demonstrates, there are many promising approaches and emerging knowledge that combined can lead us in the right direction. Smarter assessments can make us all smarter and help us deliver on the promise of an excellent and equitable education for all students. I know it's one thing to set the vision and another thing entirely to translate it into tools that meet the needs of educators, administrators, parents, and every student. Your partnership, your ideas, and your expertise are making a difference. We are grateful to have you here. I hope that you have a productive meeting today and take advantage of this moment to innovate, to accelerate, and go deeper for all students. I want to thank you for committing this time. I want to thank you for your commitment to equity and excellence for all students, and I look forward to the productive conversation today. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, from one educator, we're heading over to another. I'd like to welcome Farida Mama, a former teacher and current principal who's met with President Obama specifically on the issue of testing and is going to talk to us today from the perspective of an educator. Farida, come on up. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for that introduction. Good morning.
Good morning.
This was the door to my very first classroom. On September 8th, 2011, I walked through this door and I started my first year teaching English as a second language at a middle school called the Lilla G. Frederick Pilot Middle School in Boston. Starry-eyed and green, I thought to myself, I've got this. After all, if teachers teach, then students learn, right? Not quite. My name is Farida Mama, and I am a principal resident with the Up Education Network. It is my privilege to speak with you today about my experience as a teacher using data to help my remarkable students grow and learn in my classroom. Something that people learn very quickly about me is that I care a lot about numbers. I am a former math teacher. Let's start with a number that, when I first started teaching, kept me up at night. 18%. At the end of the 2011-2012 school year, 18% of eighth grade students graduated from the Lilla G. Frederick Pilot Middle School proficient in mathematics. To be clear, proficiency on the end of year Massachusetts state test, the MCAS, meant that you were able to complete math at basic grade level proficiency. Upon learning about this data, I asked myself, well, what about the 82%? What about the 82% of students who were not leaving eighth grade demonstrating basic grade level proficiency? Research shows that eighth grade algebra serves as a gateway course, a course in which success is correlated with higher rates of college acceptance, attendance, and completion. So what did the future hold for our eighth grade students who are not graduating on track to access ninth grade algebra 2? If 82% of our eighth graders were not able to perform mathematics at grade level, were we truly setting them up with the skills and knowledge necessary to put them on a path to and through college? In the winter of 2012, I learned that the elementary school that many of my scholars had attended was going to reopen in the fall as a new school called Up Academy Dorchester. I'd heard about the Up Education Network doing restart work in chronically underperforming schools in Massachusetts, and I was excited by their mission for two reasons. One, Up restarts schools, keeping the same exact students, but changing the systems and routines in the building. And two, how incredible to take on the unique challenge of restart work in the same neighborhood, but earlier on in a student's academic career. With this in mind, I chose to take my career there and became the founding fifth grade math teacher. I met Gigi, a fifth grade student, on the first day of school. I greeted Gigi warmly and introduced myself. Hi, I am Miss Mama, and I am so excited to teach you math this year. The moment Gigi heard math, her bright smile faded, and her excitement was replaced with skepticism. The skepticism was understandable. In the fourth grade, Gigi attended a chronically underperforming school. To be more specific, the John Marshall School was a level 3 school, which put it in the lowest 20% of schools in the state. A school with achievement rates so dismally low that it was deemed in need of total restart. At the end of each school year, the MCAS collects data on individual student performance as well as subgroup and whole school performance. Let's take a look at some of the data. Gigi's fourth grade class was entering fifth grade 14% proficient in mathematics and 10% proficient in language arts. Fourth grade students do not take a science MCAS. However, the most recent graduating fifth grade class had graduated elementary school only 4% proficient in science. Gigi, now a fifth grader, had scored warning on her fourth grade math MCAS. Having attended this school for her entire academic career, yeah, she had a right to be skeptical. As reflected in this assessment data, teachers were teaching, but students were not learning. These numbers highlight a narrative that is all too pervasive in our country and one that is true for too many of our most vulnerable populations. We can do better. We must do better. Gigi's skepticism did not fade quickly. It was painfully evident that Gigi wanted to be anywhere but math class. I'm not a doctor, but I do not believe that Gigi's math-induced stomachache was a coincidence, mostly because it magically disappeared at the start of PE class. At times, when Gigi encountered a problem that she deemed too challenging, I'd find her on the verge of tears. "I can't do it, Miss Mama," she would say, with her head bowed and tears welling in her eyes. In these moments, I wondered, where did we go so wrong? As parents in the audience know, children come into this world with the belief that they can do anything. They may fall, but they almost always get right back up. With Gigi, I was determined to reignite in her the belief that she could, she must, get right back up. So using assessment data from the year before, I strategized. Over the course of the year, I used interim assessments to make course corrections. Sometimes the data told me that kids needed more practice. Other times, the data suggested that kids hit an objective out of the park. And sometimes the data told me that my students needed more of a challenge. To support Gigi, I developed an individual plan that included assignments that created access points that were appropriate for her skill level. I gave her small group learning, extra in-school tutoring, and extra math practice during Saturday school. I remember giving students golden tickets to make them feel like they were attending the most prestigious Saturday event that ever existed. In hindsight, Saturday school seemed like a pie-in-the-sky idea. I'd originally planned for a group of 10 fifth grade students to meet on the weekend at the local library. But apparently my antics worked, because that year, upwards of 60 students in grade 3 through 5 signed up for Saturday school that year, proudly waving their golden tickets. These supports look different for every student. I knew that a one-size-fits-all approach was not what was going to help each student fulfill their highest potential. In the fall of 2014, Gigi walked into sixth grade an advanced mathematician. To date, the single most joyful moment of my career in education was sharing this news with Gigi and her family. Furthermore, the assessment data revealed that 20% of Gigi's classmates, the class that had graduated only 14% proficient in mathematics, was entering sixth grade advanced in math. 60% of scholars were leaving fifth grade proficient or higher. That year, assessment data indicated that teaching and learning had happened. In the fall of 2015, I learned that Gigi and her peers would no longer be attending a failing school. After 2 years of data analysis, frequent progress monitoring, and targeted interventions implemented not just in my classroom, but school-wide, Gigi and her classmates went from walking into a chronically underperforming school to attending a level 1 school, which in Massachusetts is the highest designation a school can receive from the state. 2 months ago, I walked into an eighth grade classroom and I watched Gigi lead a classroom full of her peers in a meaningful discussion around rigorous math content. At Up Academy Dorchester, eighth grade students are practicing the skills and knowledge that will get them on a path to and through college. In reflection, standardized assessment data illuminated that there was a situation in which teaching and learning were disparate and needed to be addressed urgently. State assessment and interim assessment data gave teachers the tools needed to course correct early. And now, assessment data shows that there has been a dramatic shift in the teaching and learning happening at this school. Great. So why aren't the same shifts happening everywhere that state tests are taken? Because it can't start and end with a test. Over the past few weeks, I've connected with some of the most inspiring leaders I know to get under the hood of what makes the difference for kids. And here's what I learned. 1, end-of-year assessments are a floor, not a ceiling. What really matters is the task that we put in front of our students. The task predicts the performance, and tests are a measure by which we can see if students have learned what we taught. 2, the best leaders empower teachers to see tests as tools to gain insight into how kids are doing and differentiate accordingly. The best leaders are able to frame assessments not as a stick, but as one indicator of how are we doing as a place of learning. Are we keeping our promise to students and families? And what are our pockets of strength and how do we spread these? end-of-year assessments are one part, but not the only part, of a strong school program. End-of-year assessments must be tied to ongoing practices. Strong programming includes interim assessments, aligned curriculum, and also a framework by which teachers can share best practices with each other. Not best practices in someone's opinion, but best practices that are illuminated and confirmed by data. And finally, not all of life's lessons can be measured on an end-of-year assessment. Lessons like work hard, be kind, and take care of one another. After all, what is school without joy and a little magic? It is my responsibility to ensure that my scholars leave my classroom equipped with the knowledge and skills that make college a viable option. I am, after all, shaping future scientists, engineers, and senators. But just as importantly, I am responsible for nurturing the creativity of future bakers and athletes too. To gain a little more insight into what really matters to the students we serve, I asked Gigi, how will you know that you've been successful at UAD once you graduate? This was her response. I will know I've been successful at UAD when I graduate UAD, moving on to an excellent high school with the knowledge and skills that I need for 9th through 12th grade and beyond, and having the ability to bounce back and interact with people different from me. In my new role as a principal in residence, I am constantly reminded that teaching is singularly the hardest work in the world. It is also the most important work in the world. Every day, 3,754 students walk into chronically underperforming schools in Massachusetts. Without a strong educational foundation, most other doors in life would remain closed to scholars like Gigi, Avante, Janila, Francisco, and Maya. However, by using assessment data as a light to illuminate a path forward, my door can be the first of just many they choose to walk through for the rest of their lives. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Frida, and that was a wonderful presentation, really grounded us in the perspective of a teacher and a principal, so we're really grateful for that. It's now my privilege to welcome a panel filled with experts on assessment and those actually doing the work on the ground. So if we could have our panelists come up onto our pseudo stage up here and join us. We'll have some questions and discussion amongst the panelists, and then there'll be an opportunity to ask questions over at the microphone over there. So when the time is right, Jean Wilhad, our wonderful moderator, will signal, and with that, I'll turn it over to you, Jean. Thank you.
Good morning. All right, you have before you, I'm not going to spend a lot of time. We have limited time for this panel discussion. I'm not going to go into backgrounds. You can find them on whatever system you'd like to access. They're all varied in their expertise and the background. And we're gathered here to learn a little bit more about assessment and how we can improve assessment. We're here to add some meaning to the difficult conversations that are going on across the country today, and we are here to provide some direction for that future. So this panel should be able to help us with this. Better, fairer, fewer. There's not a person in this room who wouldn't say, that's really laudable. But how do you bring those things together in some meaningful ways? That is the really challenging issue for all of us. So we're going to try to explore this in some way. I'm going to turn, first of all, to Joanna. As many of you know, in her work, she's written and talked about the issues of worthy assessments. Assessments that measure complex and realistic kinds of skills that students are going to use in society. She also talks about the need for assessments to be multiple, that a single measure is not adequate for determining student direction. So better assessments. I'm going to add another word there, fewer. I think there's a bit of a conflict here. How does one develop better assessments along the lines that you've advocated, Joanna, and yet address this issue of parents demanding less testing, teachers feeling overwhelmed with testing regime, administrators concerned that they're unable to keep the faculty on task. Care to respond to that dilemma?
Thank you, Jean, and thank you for the invitation to come this morning. Apologize, I have a bit of a cold. So I think starting with the how do we justify the conflict between better assessments and fewer assessments, I think we have to start by asking, well, what's the purpose of assessment? And one of the things that we advocate in our research before ever starting to design an assessment is having a theory of action of what are the assessments, not just the individual ones, but in their entirety as a system intended to accomplish. And I think it's only by looking at that theory of action, saying ultimately, what am I trying to accomplish with these assessments, formative, interim, summative, as part of the larger educational system, can I judge whether in fact I have enough, too much, or too few? Because each one has its own role. And then as you start to think about how to design a better assessment tool for each of those purposes, you have to think about, well, what is its individual purpose in that larger system? Is it just progress monitoring where I want to drop in very quickly and just get a sense of where students are? Or is it something where I want to dig deeply into a particular content area and generate a hypothesis of where they might be at this time that the teacher can use to make some decisions about their instructional action? You can't just look at a list and say, here are all of our assessments, that's too many. It has to be much more based in terms of what your goal is of those assessments. And for most of us, it's that each individual is learning and being given the opportunities to learn the best they can.
So how do we get in this conundrum? And what are we going to do about it?
So I think we have very well-intentioned educators, policymakers, who saw the opportunity of data collection as a way to give information to people to be able to make decisions. But I think there's also a bit of a naive understanding of assessment and what it is. I mean, people think of assessment as test and they think of it as one thing, and it is just more complex than that. I also think that the assessment tools that have traditionally served us very well because they were designed for specific purposes no longer fit the needs and the purposes, as well as no longer maybe address the goals of education. We have a 21st century education system that has a broader range of skills that are technology embedded for people to be able to be successful engaging in the 21st century world. That's very different than what our original tests were designed for. So some of our tried and true methodologies maybe don't need to be thrown out the window, but need to evolve, and we need to think about how those play out to meet our newer needs. And technology certainly plays a big role in that, but we have to be very careful as we bring those new technologies in that we're not introducing more barriers, greater disparity among individuals that are, in fact, the most needy and most vulnerable in our system.
So, Johnny, you brought in the third aspect of this, and I'm going to turn to Martha on it, and that's this issue of fair inclusiveness. And Martha, you have throughout your career advocated for better service to those students who have unique needs and that are underserved in this issue, in this whole area of assessment and service. So how do we begin to develop new innovative kinds of practices and not leave some of these students by the way?
I think we've actually made a lot of progress in this area. I have been in this working on this question about how do you make sure that you are inclusive of all so that you really get information on their knowledge and skills, not on their disability or their limited English skills. So I've been doing this a long time, and when I started, it was about what can we do to fix what we've already got? A lot of retrofitting going on. I think in the past decade or so, there's really been a shift, for the most part, not everywhere, a real shift toward let's think about all students from the beginning, and that means we also think about students who are challenged by a disability or a limited English proficiency. That shift has to continue. Most of the focus in that shift has been at the state test level. And I think we've made great progress there. Technology has helped, but it's also created some additional challenges for us. But we also need to be thinking about all those other assessments that are really critical for measuring progress in the classroom, et cetera.
So there are a lot of folks here from local school districts. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of this for their practice?
Well, the implications are keep pushing for better assessments that are actually have that fair part to them from the beginning. Also, I think right now we have a huge challenge in that there's been a lot of innovation in assessments, a lot of shift in how we think about accessibility, no longer just accommodations. We've got tiers of supports, things available to everybody, features that are available to all students if they have a specific need that results in their needing that accessibility support and then accommodation. So huge shifts, and what I see particularly in districts and schools is confusion about, well, what are those? We don't really understand those different tiers of support. What do they mean? Or so professional development related to that is going to be really important. Also, I'm a teacher who's never been on an IEP team, but I have a student I think could really needs, has a need that really would benefit from a certain support. How do I make that decision? How do I know for sure that that student does have a need that would require an accessibility support? So professional development, I think, is going to be really important out in the field so that all educators understand what options are open to them in their assessments.
Again, I'm going to move to you. Does any of this sound familiar? You're the only person on this panel who's doing this work day-to-day in a specific school district, a big school district with complex issues. What are you struggling with right now around assessment design, implementation, support?
Sure. I think a lot of what Martha alluded to is kind of real for us in New York City. I think we are consistently looking for ways in which we can support our teachers and educators kind of in the individual buildings about how to appropriately make those decisions, whether it be for accommodations or accessibility features on state tests or for local assessments. You know, we don't want kind of students to have a certain accommodation for the very first time on a state test to not be something that they're getting throughout the course of their normal instruction, whether it be a classroom-based formative assessment or something that it that is offered district-wide. So I think we continue to seek ways in which we can try and work with folks in the schools about understanding what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate to really be able to measure how students are progressing on those skills that the assessment is trying to measure. I think, you know, we are kind of working with schools, you know, in New York City that have students that have a wide range of supports that are needed, whether it be for students with disabilities or English language learners or just general ed students that we are trying to figure out how accessibility and accommodations are appropriate and help level the playing field so we can really get an accurate measure of how students are performing.
As you do this work, what's causing you to wake up at 3 a.m. and sort of panic about what's on the agenda tomorrow?
Sure. I wouldn't say I wake up in a panic, but I think there's a lot of exciting things that we're doing.
That's strange. I used to do it a lot.
I think you know, there are a number of things that we're excited about. I think the potential for technology, New York State is going through a process of transitioning from the traditional paper-based test to digital-based assessments for our annual reading and math test. So I think that's something that we continue to try and think through, and how do we ensure that there's equitable access for all of our students across our million-plus students, right? And so, you know, what I continue to be thinking about is how do we ensure that what students are being exposed to on a day-to-day basis in the classroom essentially matches the method in which we're going to assess them, right? So as we move to a digital-based assessment, are students exposed and familiar with those supports that they're going to use on the assessment? As a former math teacher, you know, I would struggle kind of with using an equation editor. And so if the very first time that a kid is using an equation editor is on the state math test, I would question whether or not we're really getting an accurate measure of whether or not the student understands the skill being assessed, or did they struggle with how do I write a fraction or how do I need to cognitively think about the process of what I'm doing versus simply answering the question.
Great. All right, Zoran, you work in the field of innovation in education and in other fields. We've had the hope of technology, and I'm wondering if there is much beyond hope as you look at this area of assessment in education. What are some of the potential improvements that we can make in assessment design that could be enhanced through technology?
I think there's a lot of promise. I mean, mainly because things are so terribly bad right now. I kind of say it as an outsider because, you know, as an engineer, I come in.
We thought we were innovating here.
You look at sort of how the tests or most of the things that happen in the classroom are happening, and, you know, as an engineer, you're used to sort of rapid iteration loops. You know, you basically don't know very much about anything, so the quicker you can sort of get things and the quicker they can direct what you do next, the better success you're going to have on anything. But these iteration loops are nothing but rapid, and there is no iteration. So even for the formative tests that are called formative, you know, you kind of have, you know, maybe a number for every kind of, at best, maybe a section in a standard or something. But, you know, is the teacher really going to take that number and somehow know exactly what to do with different set of students? I mean, it just doesn't happen when you look at what happens in the classroom. So really what I've been focusing on is to say, how can basically an assessment just be truly, not just formative, but really sort of specialized for every aspect of what can actually change with respect to what you learn about the students? So what that means is not just what the student should be doing next, but what should be the type of organization in the classroom that would most benefit the set of students that we just understood where they are? What are the set of things, what are the exact explanations for which group of students that would be most productive for the key set of misconceptions that have been identified for those kinds of students? And how do they affect not just the actual content, but maybe their metacognitive skills? How do they approach being stuck on a set of problems, or maybe even how do they sort of think about their mindset in light of what is being detected in those assessments? So that's the kind of thing that we've been working on. And I can tell you now, for example, we've been conducting this statewide challenge in Washington State, Minnesota, and the entire country of Norway, and we asked sort of crazy questions like, can elementary students learn key set of things about solving algebraic equations? And when you have these kind of rapid iteration loops on the entire state level for just a week, and you ask teachers to just take one and a half hours on this thing, you can get 96% of the entire K-12 spectrum be able to solve linear equations after that week. So these kind of iteration loops make some of these things possible. Now, that was a very narrow thing, right? It doesn't cover the entire thing. But it just points to what kinds of things ends up being possible. And so the key thing for me is action. If there is no action that's very targeted and specific after any kind of assessment, from my perspective, I mean, there are purposes for summative and all these other tests, but really I'm thinking about sort of what can I, and, you know, and it's not some graphs or huge amount of numbers that you can present to teachers, because that produces nothing as well. You know, teachers being overwhelmed and stuff. No, it has to be exact, you know, for example, here's a dynamically generated problem that you should work with these three kids that have exactly this kind of confusion. These other three kids you should group together because one kid just realized something that she can share with the other kids, right? So those are the kinds of actions. Give Nancy a high five because she just had a light bulb moment on exactly how to deal with fractions with different. So basically, there are incentive structures, there are specific organizations, and that kind of action has impact not just on students, but on teacher PD. So now, because they have a fast iteration loop, they know of all the things that they're trying, which one of these things end up actually directly helping different kids. And so that kind of learning, to me, is way more important than some kind of webinar on abstract ways in which you should be teaching kids, which is sort of usually how we do this PD, and problem of transfer of that onto the actual thing of what happened in the classroom just doesn't exist. And finally, these kinds of interventions can also be used to test the interventions. In many ways, you know, kids are wonderfully plastic. They will just, given right opportunities, they'll do the best they can. But we shouldn't be testing them for the purposes of evaluating them. We should really be evaluating the curriculum, the content, and the interventions. And if you have these fast iteration loops, even for the small, you can say this curriculum or this intervention or this sort of online product that we're using is useful for these kinds of concepts, but completely flatlines on some of these other ones. And that, you know, that, you know, even developers, you know, in many ways would be used, well, most of them will, otherwise benefit from sort of Wild West and let's just sell anything to schools. But that kind of rapid iteration loop doesn't just affect the students, it affects the entire ecosystem. And that's the kind of really big promise that I'm excited about.
And this rapid iteration is more a statement about practice in the classroom, interaction with students, than it is around the technology?
Well, obviously the technology needs to allow for it, right? So if you have only two computers in a classroom, how are you going to do that? But it turns out there is a way in which you can send two kids on a rotation. So basically the computers just say, okay, and in fact, I would like to question one more thing that has been said here, which is that they have to be fewer. I don't think the assessments need to be fewer. They just need to be drastically shorter and more targeted. Okay, so if you can actually do something, if you can have the insight in the whole classroom for 7 minutes of that classroom, teachers are going to do it every day. It's not going to be few, but they're going to be useful because everything that a teacher does during that day, or maybe even at the end of the classroom, what they do the next day, will directly be, you know, even, you know, some when they realize something at the end of the module, it's too late. They're not going to do anything for those kids, right? So unless there's something that they can actually figure out almost on a daily basis. Now, the question is, how can you assess things in 7 minutes, right? And so that means that's where technology comes in. So you don't just have a multiple choice where you select some set of answers, because then you have to answer 20 multiple choice questions to really differentiate the key thing that they need. What if you can follow their thinking process as they're solving the actual problem that they're doing? You can, with one problem, you can get insight into basically two or three grades of material of stuff that they have to bring to bear to in order to solve that problem. And they can even do 20% of that completely wrong, and you can still give them huge amount of credit for the set of things that they were able to answer. And that's the kind of technological sort of answers that we're trying to do, which is if you follow their thinking process, you can know exactly what the misconceptions are, you can know exactly how they face adversity, what do they do when they don't know how to solve the problem, how do they use their metacognitive skills, and you know exactly what their sort of persistence and mindset is with respect to solving those kinds of problems.
So the issue may not be too many tests, it's the relevance of the test to the learning process.
You know, they have to be sure. There's no way they can take that much time. And, you know, if you really want to have a formative thing about the module that I'm teaching now, I don't need to know about 10,000 other things like big module tests. Or I can test the very specific thing for a very, very short amount of time.
Joanna, you've been working on this at ETS. What are your reactions to this?
So there was a lot said in that answer that I was trying to kind of track. But let's start with the question or the proposition that the tests need to be more and shorter. And I don't think that that's always the case, because I do think that there is some learning objectives and goals that we have for very complex integrated types of skills, and we want to know about how a student is going to apply those in a very rich context. And at times that's going to require an activity that may take longer to unfold. Now that might not be for formative purposes, so the type of short assessments that you're talking about, I think for certain types of skills and to identify certain types of very specific misconceptions can be very useful. And I think a well-designed assessment that allows you to accumulate evidence over a short period of time and then make a directed decision for what to do next, that's appropriate. But I think in other cases, it may be that you need an entire class period or a formative assessment that lasts a couple of weeks because it has various components to it and you're getting that in, you're accumulating that information over a longer period of time. Something that I think was raised by Zoran that is incredibly important, though, is the idea, and we are doing a lot of work on this, of how much information and evidence can we glean from the assessments and making those assessment moments as valuable as possible. So not just taking the final answer that they have and judging their competency based on that. How did they get to that point? And what does that mean about the way they're reasoning, about the way they're approaching the problem, both in terms of their understanding of the competencies, but also something potentially about their persistence and the types of goals that they set for themselves. And that's where technology can really be useful, because we can get a trace of the way a person solves a problem. And I'll just give one brief example of some work that's been coming out of a CBAL initiative, cognitively based assessment of, for, and as learning, mm-hmm. that has generated basically a keystroke tracker. So as a student is writing their response to an essay prompt, the teacher could actually go back and look at the way that student created that essay. How did they edit it? Did they start with their kind of main idea? Were they fluent in the writing? And that tells the teacher something about what that means about where that student might need the most help, not just what the final product was. That gives us much richer information that we can make some formative hypotheses about and informs instruction. But it might not be very short, necessarily. Yeah.
Nika, as Zoran and Joanna described this kind of interaction between technology and teaching and learning, I wonder what's going through your mind. How far are we from that in our classrooms, and what do you think we're going to need to get to a point where we have a set of practices that mirror the kind of assessments that we're trying to design?
Sure, I think, I think the true answer to your question is it varies. I think we've got a number of schools in New York City that are, incredibly advanced in their use of technology and are thoughtful in how they're using technology on a day-to-day basis to support instruction, for teachers to be prepared and think through kind of how that instruction then leads into assessment and then that cycle coming out of the assessment to really impact instruction going again. I think there are others that are kind of concerned or apprehensive about the transition to technology, right? It's different than how they've traditionally either taught in their classroom or how they may have experienced learning a particular content or subject area themselves. And so, unfortunately, I'd like to say that, one size fits all and we could be there tomorrow, but that's just not the reality. And it's not the reality in New York City, and it's likely not the reality anywhere. Some schools and teachers and students will be pretty well prepared for a transition to taking advantage of some of the types of potential that technology offers, and others will need a longer runway to really be prepared for actively and appropriately leveraging technology in assessment.
Just a note, there's a mic over here. So I would invite everybody to jump into this conversation with issues that you might want to follow up on a comment that was made on the panel, or you may want to raise the issue that we haven't raised at this point for conversation. But then I'm going to turn to Martha. There's a lot of conversation around students with disabilities and English language learners. There are some unique challenges before us in these areas as we move assessments forward. I don't think it's enough to say we just need better practices with those students. I think there are some real serious issues around assessments and responding to those assessments. I wonder how you would summarize some of the major challenges that we face there.
Well, I think some of what we've already heard and about the variability of implementation, it's much more challenging even. I was going to say much worse, but it is much worse for students with disabilities and English learners. If you talk about access to technology, they tend not to have as much. If you talk about professional development on important content, their educators, special educators and EL development educators tend not to have as much access to that professional development. So we have just huge challenges that way. When we talk specifically about the assessment, I mean, I do think we've made huge, huge, huge leaps in improving those assessments for those populations because we have more often lately thought about those students from the beginning. So it's not just thinking about accommodations and accessibility features. It's really from the very beginning thinking about the design of the items themselves, making sure we know what they're trying to, what the concept or the construct they're trying to get at, and what are extraneous concepts that we don't want to also be measuring because they create those barriers for students who have disabilities or who are English learners. Even, I'd say, even with the dramatic improvements that have been made with some of the consortia assessments, and I would say virtually all of the consortia assessments, six of them, not just the two regular assessments, even with all those improvements, they had to do that, develop those assessments in such a short time. Everything was rapid. Trying to make sure that you're thinking about all students from the beginning is difficult when you have a very short time period. I think we saw some of the biggest challenges, but not the only challenges, related to students who had sensory impairments of some kind. I think some of the challenges also have been for the English learners who are very new to the country or very beginning in their skills, and I don't think we that the assessments necessarily have yet completely been able to address those issues. There are plenty more issues. I think a lot of them, no matter how good we get our assessments, whether the state assessments and classroom assessments, interim assessments, no matter how good we get them, if we don't use those data, and I like Zoran's ideas, I haven't seen it anywhere, but I love the ideas, but no matter how good no matter how good those assessments are, we still have issues in the classroom. Our expectations for students in subgroups often are not what they should be, so we expect less of them. That creates huge problems for these groups of students. Universal design for learning not implemented everywhere. So I think there are huge in-classroom, not assessment-specific issues.
Go ahead, Nika.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree kind of with everything that Martha said. I think, you know, thinking about technology, technology can be a great tool, but I also think there's a lot of great and exciting stuff that we're doing without technology, right, that is still kind of really impactful for students. So, you know, you talked about kind of various subgroups. If we think about English language learners, I mean, there's a couple of exciting things that we're doing in New York City. So, in addition to typically translating our assessments into 9 alternate languages to really be able to try and overcome whether it's the language issue or the content, to really be able to provide meaningful data back to the educators. We're also kind of working through providing tools for general ed teachers and English as a new language teachers, you know, do you have language acquisition rubrics that you can apply on top of the content rubric? So can you really identify where students are really in their progress of acquiring those language skills to be able to respond to the test questions itself? So it's not necessarily only about the content, whether or not you got the question right or wrong, but how are you progressing in acquiring all of those skills? We're also providing kind of home language arts assessments, where you know in Spanish which is our largest kind of English as a new language population, to be able to assess whether or not it's the the English that students are struggling with, or is it the skill? You know, can we measure where they are on these complex kind of skills and comprehension traits that we're really trying to measure? So as a teacher, do I need to work with those students because they don't understand the concept, or is it the language that's the barrier here, right? So we're trying to provide tools that aren't just kind of dependent on technology as the potential to save all of or solve all of our problems, right? There are a lot of exciting things that we're doing in assessment in a traditional manner right now as supports for educators.